Well, I'm going to talk about wildfires, which is something seems very unrelated to crime, although there are some parallels. One being that, obviously, the data have a space-time component. Another being that, at least in California, many of the wildfires are, some of them, at least, are started as a result of crime, arson. It's estimated around 30% of the ones in Los Angeles County are started as a result of arson. About 90% of them are started as a result of man-caused activities, the other 10% being caused by lightning. But a lot of the man-caused activities that cause wildfires are not related to crime. There's accidents, industrial accidents, camping accidents, and so on. However, there is that 30% or so that's the result of crime. I'll be talking mostly about sort of background stuff dealing with wildfires, and a little bit about point process models and how to build or construct point process models to fit this wildfire data. And how to evaluate those models as well. This is a little list of people that I should thank. People from Herb Spitzer, Frank Vidalis, Mike Takeshita from the LA County Fire Department and Los Angeles Department of Public Works for helping me to get the data, and also a few students and colleagues who helped me do some of this work. I also should thank Dick Burke, the guy who introduced me, not only for introducing me in this talk, but also for introducing me to this subject. It was Dick who, he knew that I had studied earthquakes before and point processes and their applications to earthquakes, and thought, I guess he was dabbling with wildfire data and thought, hey, this is something that you might be into. So thank you for that. Now, this is a point map of the centroids of some of these Los Angeles County wildfires. These are the centroids of wildfires burning at least 10 acres that are in the database from 1960 to 2000. I won't get too much into the little issues with the data, but just let it be said that this data set has the kinds of problems that are typical of any data set that you might analyze in statistics, especially, the errors in the locations are thought to be relatively small, on the order of 10 meters. However, missing data is a big problem. Nowadays, they record wildfires burning down to 1 acre or less. Of course, they qualify it as a wildfire only if it burns greater than 1 acre. However, the data set is thought to be grossly incomplete, except for wildfires burning at least about 10 acres since about 1950. And it should also be said that while we can generate a map of points like this, wildfires aren't points. I'm not sure if this corresponds to crime as well, but really there's a sort of area burned by a wildfire, not just a point. But for simplicity, it's often convenient to model the centroids of the fires. A little bit of history about Los Angeles County wildfire, the fire department, and studied wildfires in this area. It was about 1907 that the Los Angeles County Fire Department started. Before that, in the late 1800s, there was a group, an agency, I'm forgetting the word. They had a sort of group of people that were interested in studying fires. And in 1907, the fire department was formed, but it originally was just set up to study fires, too. It wasn't until the 1950s that the fire department was actually given the task of trying to put some of these fires out. And then things changed in the 70s a lot, nationally, when, due to a series of papers, people started coming up with the theory of prescribed burning. That is, it was noticed that after a place burns, it tends not to burn in the near future thereafter. And so in addition to the development of this national fire danger rating system, this sort of burning issue came about that was fun to study weather. Okay, you don't like all puns. That is the issue of, is it worth it to actually set certain parts of the landscape ablaze in order to prevent or mitigate the risk of future fires happening. Now there again, the analogy with crime might not extend. I doubt that the Los Angeles Police Department will go and burglarize certain houses so that they don't get burglarized shortly thereafter.
It's a good idea.
That's a good idea. Just what brings to mind. There was a Saturday Night Live fake ad where there's a car with a, I wonder if any of you have seen it, it was on the 90s, where on the outside it looks like a beat up like 1983 Datsun, but it has the engine of a Lamborghini and the interior of a Rolls Royce. In 1976, nationally, there were instituted these ROS, remote access weather stations. And these are automatic stations that record weather information, precipitation, temperature, wind direction, wind speed, and some other variables on the hour, every hour. And there are about 17 of them in Los Angeles County. And every day at 1 p.m., their information is just automatically sent to a headquarters in Missoula, Montana, where that data is analyzed. And one of the things that can be computed based on that data is called the burning index. Now, one of the kind of the direction I'm going in this talk is that first I'll tell you a bit about the burning index. And it's kind of a model for predicting wildfires. And so you might think, hey, this task is done. We've already got the burning index. Well, I'll tell you why I don't think that is the complete end of the story and why there may be a reason to pursue further directions into point process, other kinds of models for wildfires. But just first, a little more background about wildfires in Los Angeles. 2003 was a really big year for wildfires here, with over 700,000 acres burned, causing the destruction of 3,600 homes. 26 people died in those fires. And most of this happened in a period of just about 9 days, from October 24th to November 2nd, where the vast majority of that damage happened. That's typical, by the way, that in the fall is typically the most dangerous season in Los Angeles for wildfires. You might think it would be the summer, but in the fall, we have the hot, dry Santa Ana winds that propel these fires. Notice also that different wildfires may cause vastly different amounts of damage just depending on where they burn. A couple of examples here, the Bel Air 1961 fire burned only 6,000 acres but resulted in $30 million of damage, whereas the Clampett 1970 fire burned so much more, 107,000 acres, but only cost $7.4 million of damage. So it all depends on what the property values of the land that burns is. The records from the Los Angeles County Fire Department on fires in Los Angeles go back to 1878, something like that. And you could plot burn area versus year here. And you can, if you look at this, you could see there's some kind of increase, I guess, generally. But I can't. This is probably due to a low detection rate of fires more than anything else, up till about 1950. Since 1950, we don't see any really clear trend, even though there is a trend in temperature. There is a relatively clear trend of an increased temperature in Los Angeles.
What kind of temperature are you
quoting? These are monthly mean air temperatures in the Los Angeles Basin.
High for the day? Is it the average? Is it the mean high for the day?
That's a good question. I don't really remember. I think it was not. I think it's just the mean. The mean.
The high gets about 20 a lot of money in the summer. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, now it does. Didn't always. Now this, you know, might not be due to global warming, but there's certainly a local warming going on in Los Angeles County. Although I guess some may say that's even that's a matter of debate. Now, one thing when you first look at this data, it kind of jumps out at you that there is something going on in terms of inhibition between fires of one year and the next. Here's an example. If I plot the fires, that is the exact locations that burned in 1963 and 1964, that's this plot here. And this portion here is just a blow up of this portion. So these are the places that burned in 1963 and 1964, and you can see from these two plots that this middle portion burned in 1963, and it seems kind of conspicuous that it didn't burn again in 1964, just the sort of outlying parts burned in 1964. So this lends some validity to that theory that if a place burns one year, it's not going to burn the next. So certainly that is a feature of the data. Okay, now, I want to talk about the burning index first a bit. And, some background. The National Fire Danger Rating System imports this data from the remote access weather stations, and it exports a bunch of indices, one of them being the burning index. And from talking with fire captains and other fire experts here in Los Angeles County, it seems that the burning index is the one that they actually use in terms of issuing warnings and assigning personnel and equipment. Now, the burning index uses the daily weather variables as well as a kind of drought index, which is measured by this cumulative precipitation on previous days, and also some vegetation information. It doesn't include anything about human interactions. And this is probably a problem with crime statistics and their evaluation as well. In some sense, if the police department is using a forecaster of crime to try to prevent or decrease the amount of crime, then you wouldn't expect it to correlate so well with the amount of crime. But that's the case here as well. So ignoring any human involvement, that is, in terms of ignition and also in putting out these fires, the burning index is kind of used as a measure of the risk. Now, I list here just a few of the equations that go into the computation of the burning index. I don't want to go into these in detail at all, except just to impress upon you how complex this is. It involves the solution to nonlinear equations. And also, there's some feedback mechanism going on here. That is, temperature leads to increased risk of wildfire. But also, obviously, wildfires increase the temperature around them. There's also a similar thing with wind. That is, high winds tend to propel large wildfires, but wildfires themselves cause a kind of internal wind that propels them. So there are these, the BI is an incredibly complicated system of equations, and it involves these weather variables. That's the main thing I just want you to get out about. Now, I should give a little bit of maybe my history into this process. When I first started working on wildfires, first I started sort of questioning some of the equations that go into the computation of the BI. And when I presented that to people in the Los Angeles County Fire Department, because I wanted to do something that they actually used, the reaction was very much, yeah, that's nice, but we've got the BI. We're happy with the BI. And you know, you can see here I've listed a number of reactions from sort of fire people that they think it works great. There's very little evidence of that, though. There are a few papers that support or evaluate certain European and Canadian systems of doing something similar. there are a few papers that have evaluated the fire potential index, which is a component in the burning index. And of course, there are several papers that have assessed specific equations in the BI and always seeming to confirm them. And it's important to note that the equations in the BI, where did they come from? Some come from well-established physical or chemical principles. Many of the coefficients, though, come from laboratory experiments, where mostly done in the 70s, where literally people lit a match in an oven and saw how quickly the stick burned. That's supposed to relate to wildfires? I mean, one might question the validity of the burning index just based on that kind of extrapolation. Another potential problem with the burning index is that these equations which are used were based on especially experiments of Dick Rothermel, whose response variable was the height of the flame, that is what he called flame length, the height of the flame at its head. But that now is being used as a kind of indicator. So you can imagine that being a function of temperature, wind, etc. That response variable is now used as its kind of global burn index, that is the overall risk of wildfire. So, okay, already there might be some reasons to sort of question whether we should be married to this burning index. However, as I said, when I started out working in this area about 5 years ago, the reaction among fire people was, we're going to use the burning index. And so my research immediately went into, okay, how best can they use it? That is, they have a burning index on each day at each of these 17 fire stations. How can we sort of interpolate between, the stations in order to optimally estimate the wildfire risk? Yeah?
Is this for the start of a new wildfire or for it burning to certain?
That's a really important question. The question is, am I talking about predicting future wildfires or given that a wildfire occurred, where is it going to burn? And I'm only talking about the first question. So given the weather variables for that day and given that no fires have already occurred on that day, what's the chance of a wildfire initiating on that day? So the records I'm looking at are reducing each of these fires to a point, even though some of them last for up to a week, and though some of them spread across a broad area. I'm looking at just the centroids and the origin dates of these wildfires. One might inquire as to whether the BI predicts those origin dates and times accurately.
Rick, is the centroid a good way of mapping where a fire starts?
That's a good question. There's been a lot of work on that. People have modeled the fire burn areas as ellipses often, even though they're not really ellipses either. There are all kinds of anecdotes, by the way, about cases where it's not elliptical at all. And you can imagine if the wind is consistently burning in one direction, that you can have all kinds of shapes where the origin location has nothing to do with the centroid. I've heard anecdotes about, and for those of you who might be potential aspiring arsons, you should know this, that there are anecdotes about fire department officials finding evidence near what they believe to be the origin site of a wildfire that may have burned thousands of acres and destroyed entire villages and homes, of things like shoes, pieces of paper even, cigarette butts, thought to be previously owned by the people who started this wildfire. You'd think that would be long gone in this wildfire that caused so much devastation, but if it's sort of only going that direction, something could be just a few feet over here and not get destroyed. Nevertheless, okay, your question is, how good is the centroid? I don't know. It's not something I've really looked at. In an area the size of in a relatively large area like Los Angeles County, a wildfire burning 1,000 acres, it seems like it could sort of reasonably be approximated by a point. Just as a wildfire lasting a week, if you're looking over a 40-year period, you could have maybe approximated that by a point. But it's certainly a flaw. I readily admit that. And I don't really, I haven't looked at how big a flaw it is, in some sense. There was a question around here?
No, it was the same question.
Same question, great, okay. First, some evaluation of the BI. And the reason I'm talking about this is I want to motivate why I want to look at alternatives to the BI. First of all, the BI is kind of additive. By that, I certainly don't mean that it's actually an additive model. But I mean it sort of behaves like an additive model would. Whereas there's some suggestion that maybe a multiplicative model would be more appropriate. Here's what I mean. If you look at a smoothing of, say, temperature versus fuel moisture, basically two of the variables involved here, fuel moisture versus precipitation, it's like both variables have to be conducive in order for a large wildfire to occur. So here's temperatures, monthly average temperatures versus precipitation. As long as both of the variables are conducive to wildfires, then then we might say we have a high wildfire risk. But an additive model where one of the variables is especially high but the other isn't may not lead to really high risk. And the BI kind of has this feature. And one way to look at that is to represent each point. I mean, the points are kind of multidimensional here, because in each point we have all these variables, the precipitation on that day, temperature, wind speed, etc. And one way to represent that kind of data is in a plot like this. This is just for the 10 largest wildfires occurring between 1976 and 2000. I kind of like these plots for exploratory purposes. I include them in talking about them, but I've never actually published one of these. It's always the first thing to get excluded from, edited out of the paper. It's not essential, but it's really a nice exploratory tool, I think, just to look at kind of a subset of the data and see, okay, what was true of these cases, at least. And you could see, I mean, in all of these cases, the wind speed is relatively high for all of these cases. 7.3 miles per hour is substantial enough to propel a fire forward. Notice that the temperature is kind of low for a few of them. And the BI, I haven't told you about the scale of the BI. 100 is kind of standard. The BI takes a score somewhere between 0 and it's really rare that it takes a value above 200, but for this one day it took a value of 351. But generally the BI is somewhere between like 0 and 250. And if it's greater than 100, they'd say there's moderate risk. If it's greater than about 150, sometimes they issue warnings based on whether it's greater than 150. Okay. And you could see that, the BI misses some of these wildfires, and it seems to... Looking at more of these plots than just this one, the general trend is that the BI seems to be high if one of these variables is really, really high, like the temperature is really high. But if they're all kind of middle range or conducive to a wildfire, the BI will tend to be a little bit too low. That's the sense I get, at least. Yeah?
Is there some indicator for lightning or storm? I mean, I didn't see anything.
Not here, no. That's right. You would think that would be a factor.
It's probably something indicative of a storm currently through.
Well, it's not recorded by those remote automatic weather stations. So if you're suggesting that knowing whether an electric storm is coming would be a good predictor for wildfires, I totally agree. But that's not how it's currently done.
Do you have any idea what fraction of the wildfires?
Yeah, about 10% California-wide. In Los Angeles County, I'm not sure. It's probably a little less than that.
Have you looked at how your BI works where you talked about arsons and then man-made and then wildfire? Do the results change depending on which...
Separating it depending on the cause of
like
the fire?
Prime question, right?
Wow,
I mean,
that's a good question. I don't know. I don't really have that data even on fire by fire, like what which one's caused by.
Because I wouldn't imagine that BI would work for arsons. Especially since you're using steroids.
Yeah, I couldn't even speculate. I think that's a really good question that I haven't. It would be interesting to sort of repeat this analysis, but separating it by type or cause of the fire. Yeah, I don't know. I should get that data and try it. It really would be just speculation if I tried to answer now. That's good. Any other? Keep bringing the good questions, though. Okay, this problem that it's too additive is kind of a small problem. A bigger problem is that it just doesn't correlate very highly with wildfire. And you might not expect that the BI would correlate very high with wildfire because, remember, the BI is only based on the weather information for that day. So given that 90% of these are in some way caused by humans, you wouldn't think that you could predict very well whether there's going to be a wildfire based just on the weather. So we shouldn't expect the correlation to be too high. And in fact, the correlation between the BI and the amount of area burned on fires initiating in that day is 0.09, pretty low. The correlation between the BI and the number of fires occurring on that day is just 0.13. The correlation with the area per fire, which you might think the BI would correlate best with out of those three response variables, based on the fact that the BI is centered around these physics equations governing the size or the strength of the fire. You'd expect maybe that to be the highest, but it's actually the lowest of the three at just 0.076. And notice, by comparison, if you looked at the correlation between just the date and the area burned, you get a correlation of 0.06, so something comparable, just using the date. And what do I mean by that? I mean, if we took a kernel smoothing of the burn area, BA here means burn area, if I took a smoothing of the burn area in the previous 25 years, so basically this is all, my response variable analysis is using the data from 1976 to 2000, because 1976 is when the BI was implemented. Well, if I took the previous 25 years of data and just looked, okay, at a typical January 31st, how much typically burns. I could get that by smoothing out the burn area from previous years. And if I use that as a predictor of how much is going to burn on this January 31st, I'd get a correlation of about 0.06. So, okay, you could do almost as well as the BI with just a calendar. If you use wind speed alone, so none of these complicated equations, you just plug in wind speed. The average wind speed over those 17 remote access weather stations on that day, and use that and see how well that correlates with the amount of area burned in fires initiating on that day, you get a correlation of 0.159, so higher than BI. So wind is an important factor. BI may not be taking it into account in exactly the right way. A really important problem too with, here's a plot of wind speed versus area burned. Not all the points are shown on that map. A really important problem with the BI is that it tends to be too high in certain months and too low in others, just in general. This plot shows the average burning index by month. So each number here indicates a month, like this is January. So the average burning index over all January days in that 25-year period versus the average area burned. And so if the BI were a perfect predictor of area, we'd expect the points to fall along this line. But you can see sort of general patterns that in these fall months, the BI is too low. There's more burn area than we would expect. And in the winter months, the BI is too high. There's less burning than you would expect. So that's a problem. You could see that also from a plot like this. This is, so the brown bars reflect the area burned per day for October, and the sort of lightly shaded or white bars indicate the area burned per day in days in January. And they're organized into categories of BI. So you would think that if the BI were a perfect summary of the overall wildfire risk, that these bars would look pretty similar. It shouldn't matter whether it's January or October. After all, we've taken into account all the weather variables. But you could see a pretty clear difference here. In October, there's much more burn per day than in January for days with the same exact BI. Now again, this is just for Los Angeles County, and the BI is this national system. But the BI actually has inputs into it. You have to input these coefficients that are location specific. So you have to input coefficients that are based on, like the one that we use for this, for computing the BI for this data set is called Southern California Chaparral. So you'd think it would fit a little bit better. In any case, one might desire an alternative kind of model, at least as a way of evaluating for comparison how well the BI is fitting. So you could imagine wanting to create a simple point process model using the same variables that are input to the BI and seeing, okay, how well does that really simple, naive model work compared to BI? Maybe you're well familiar with point processes. I imagine in crime you also work with point process data. So a point process is just a random collection of points in some set. Mathematically, we'd call it a non-negative integer value random measure, where that is the measure for any set. This is supposed to say A here. In any set A, the measure we assign to A, what we call N of A, is just the number of points in that set. And the way people define, well, first some more definitions. Point process is simple if none of the points overlap. So that is, we would never have two fires occurring at exactly the same time in exactly the same location. Related quantity is orderly. This is defined usually just for temporal point processes. And this is where you don't have these gouges, at least in a probabilistic sense, that none of these that you don't have sort of an infinite accumulation of points near any particular time and location. And we'd say a point process is stationary if the number of points in disjoint intervals doesn't depend on where those intervals are. Now, typically we model a point process by modeling its intensity. Specifically the conditional intensity. So if we consider the easy case where the points are just in time, it's easier to define the intensity then. So for an interval like TU, N of TU just means the number of points occurring between one time and the next, between time T and U. And the overall rate, what we might call the overall rate for mu, is just, it's what you'd think a rate would be. It's the number of points in that interval divided by the size of that interval. But it's the expected number of points in that interval divided by the size of that interval. And to take a limiting rate at each point, you might think to take the limit as the size of that interval gets smaller and smaller. So this is a very natural thing to define. More generally, we can define a conditional intensity, that is, the limiting expected rate of number of points in an interval given HT, the history of what's happened previously. And HT might contain other information, such as the weather variables, etc. And if N is orderly, if the point process is orderly, then you could equivalently define the conditional intensity as the probability, the limiting probability that there is at least one point in that interval, divided by the size of the interval. Now it's been shown that the conditional intensity, or its integral, which is called the compensator, the compensator always exists, and the conditional intensity, if it exists, uniquely characterizes the distribution of a simple point process. So this suggests one way to model a point process is just writing down a model for lambda, the conditional intensity. So, as I said, people in Los Angeles County were kind of addicted to the BI, and so my early efforts in this field were just to model Lambda as a function of BI, and I just looked at like ways of kernel smoothing these BI values in order to optimally predict wildfire risk. And so you get these nice maps, but you know, although this was, I guess, considered publishable, it wasn't really very exciting to me. And I found that I couldn't predict very well the wildfire risk using the BI. And so I've tried for the last couple of years to go back to trying to persuade wildfire officials that maybe we should explore alternatives to the BI. What variables should go into such a model? Well, as one person pointed out, we could take into account a lot of variables not included in the BI, such as lightning. On the other hand, it might be desirable to include only variables that are recorded at these remote access weather stations and see how well we could do using those variables, just as a kind of experiment. So some of those variables, the most important ones, seem to be the relative humidity, the wind speed, precipitation, and the sort of total precipitation aggregated over some period of time, like 60 days. And also you need to have temperature, and date seems important as a kind of proxy for whether the Santa Ana winds are coming or not, it seems. Then there's also a size distribution that looks like the Pareto or maybe tapered Pareto distribution, the power law distribution. And then you also need some kind of spatial background, which I thought we could do just by taking a kernel smoothing of the historical, that is the pre-1976 fires. Because some locations burn and some don't, basically.
Is A area burning?
Good. By T, I mean the day. X, the bold X here is supposed to be a vector indicating the spatial location. And the A means the area of that fire. So I'm modeling the probability of a fire of a certain area occurring on a certain day in a certain location. So this is one possible way to write it out, and it's just one really simple, naive model. You'll notice that it's multiplicative. I mean, you see plus signs in here, but it's E to the sum. So it's multiplicative. And a word about the fact that it's exponential. My feeling is that a good way to construct a model for point processes is to look at one component at a time and model how the risk seems to depend on, let's say, relative humidity, and then look at how the wildfire risk seems to depend on wind speed, etc. Look at each of those components and kind of put them together as one way of building a naive multiplicative model. And that is restrictive, okay, but it's also more general than the current software for point process modeling seems to allow. That is, if you go in R and you try to fit a point process model, there's software made by Adrian Baddeley and Rolf Turner that allows you to fit essentially a log linear model, that is, a model of this form, e to the something times one term plus something times another term, etc. And I was hoping to show that we could be a little more general than that by not requiring it to be e to the something, but just the product of one term times another term times another term. But when I tried this on the wildfire data, it looked like most of these relationships were kind of exponential, unfortunately for me. An exception is date. It seems like there's this sort of peak in the relationship with date, and so that particular functional relationship doesn't look anything like exponential. Two immediate questions. How do we fit a model like this? How do we come across a model like this, and which I've started to talk about already? And how can we test whether a separable model, that is, a model that's purely multiplicative like this, is appropriate for this data set? Those are two kind of related questions. I might just kind of skip through unless they're really interesting to people. So there's, I've done some theoretical work basically on evaluating whether, under what conditions, we can look at each component separately or individually and obtain, you can imagine looking just at the relationship between the wildfire burn area and, let's say, temperature. And you might get a functional relationship and you might estimate the parameters just based on that data. Well, under what conditions will that estimate be the same or as good as your estimate if you were fitting this whole model with all of these variables together? So I've looked at some conditions called separability for cases where the resulting estimates will be equivalent. The partial maximum likelihood will be equivalent to the overall maximum likelihood. What I mean by this stuff. I know it's hard to absorb this kind of stuff in a talk. I probably shouldn't have included it at all. In general, one sort of interesting thing about this, and that's all I'll get into, it seems like, in general, the estimates obtained this way will be nice if the, what you really want is that the coordinates, the model should be multiplicative in terms of the coordinates. By that I mean things like time and area, or time and size. It's nice if the model is multiplicative in those things, but additive in terms of the covariates, like precipitation, temperature, things like that. So that's sort of a curious thing.
Does that make scientific sense to have that distinction?
What do you mean by that?
I mean, if a physicist who models fire sat down and looked at this partially multiplicative and partially additive, would they be comfortable with the physics that's implied?
Probably not. I've simplified things a little bit. So basically, it's okay if the whole thing is multiplicative. After all, in my model, the whole thing is that multiplicative.
Sure.
But basically, it's also okay if you have. I want to say it. If you have two variables, two explanatory variables, covariates, that are additive in the model, then if one of them is small, and as long as this integral is true, which is basically, again, like saying that the impact of one of them is small relative to the other, then the estimate for the other one is still going to be consistent. Now, how does that relate to reality is kind of your question.
Yeah.
Well, this comes up in...
It wasn't implying physics was real.
Okay, those results that I was just alluding to, those are important to me for the following reasons. First of all, in terms of model building, I think it suggests a way of building a model, that you can look at each component separately. Secondly, in terms of model evaluation or dimension reduction, it's easy to see if one component of the model is doing okay. It's hard to look at all of these things at the same time. And that's a really important thing. I mean, if you just set out with including all of these models together, all of these components together, like the BI, then it becomes very hard to tell if you've got a problem in modeling one of these components. And third, and this really gets to the answer to your question, there are definitely going to be variables that are important in determining wildfire risk that are excluded from the analysis. So when I've given talks about wildfires before, there's always someone asking a question, have you thought about bark beetle? Have you thought about earthworms? Have you thought about cloud cover? And the answer is always no, I haven't. And we teach, there's a notion of hypocrisy in that I teach my undergrad students even to worry about things like excluded variables and confounded factors. And that's certainly the case here. I'm sure that cloud cover and bark beetle and things like that are intimately related with the weather variables that I'm looking at and are certainly probably confounding the relationships that I'm observing. On the other hand, this theory kind of suggests that my estimates of the relationship between, let's say, wildfire hazard and temperature might not be completely invalidated just because I haven't looked at some variables such as earthworms. In the sense that if the impact of earthworms, although it may be confounding, if the impact of earthworms is relatively small compared to the impact of temperature, then at least the functional form or the parameters that I get by estimating the functional form for temperature might not be entirely invalid. Might be somewhat reasonable, as long as the interactions are not too extreme. Here's an example of one of these relationships you might get just by something like kernel regression. Again, not all the points are shown because some of them are way off the graph. But just looking at area versus wind speed, you could see a sort of maybe something like an exponential relationship. I think I should probably skip this, although let me just say that there are certain tests, I've looked into certain ways of testing whether this kind of multiplicative relationship seems satisfactory for a given data set, which is kind of nice. You might want to test whether, and just to be very short, the way it sort of works is you can look, given a data set like this, like imagine time, and this is the size of some event. So you can imagine in crime data, you've got the times of crimes and the size is the amount stolen by those burglars. And you can imagine doing a bivariate kernel smoothing, and that's what you might get here in plot B. And you can also imagine doing a univariate kernel smoothing of time, and then a univariate or marginal kernel smoothing of the sizes, and multiplying them together. And that's what's shown in C. And then a statistic that you might look at is the difference between C and B. How different are those? If they're not too different, that may suggest that a separable model might be adequate. But if they're very different, then maybe not. For Los Angeles County wildfires, I've looked at the separability of various components, and virtually everything seems roughly separable. An exception would be something like this with area and date. Even here, it looks roughly comparable, but there are little differences that are actually statistically significant, but only very marginally so. It seems that a multiplicative model is not entirely inappropriate. Now, as I mentioned, I fit exponentials in each of these terms, like in terms of relative humidity. And by max relative humidity, I mean the maximum of the recorded relative humidity for that station over the previous 24 hours. This is one of the terms that goes into the BI. Again, if you do a kernel regression, it looks roughly exponential. I'd much rather it didn't, but it does. For temperature, you have a choice. I mean, you could imagine this as an exponential if you want, if you use your imagination, or you could try a linear approximation. Either way, either model works roughly equivalently. As I mentioned, the distribution of the areas looks roughly Pareto. That would be indicated by this line, or a tapered Pareto actually fits quite a bit better. And you also need a term in there which indicates that some locations are very unlikely to experience wildfires, whereas other locations are constantly experiencing wildfires. And so the way I got that is just non-parametrically, by just kernel smoothing the historical wildfire catalog. So now some comparison. What I want to do is compare this simple model that's just taking all these exponentials and compare it with something like this, where I have beta 1, one parameter, times an exponential in some function b of t, times this spatial background, and with the same distribution of areas. So I'm just comparing my version, my really naive combination of these variables with e to the something times b. I've also looked at linear in b, where b is either relative humidity or, more appropriately, bi, more interestingly, bi. And one way to evaluate this is looking at the Akai-Ike information criterion. This is a kind of standard way of evaluating models, especially point process models, where it rewards a model for having a higher likelihood that is for fitting better, and it penalizes a model for fitting more parameters. Okay. I'm looking at the relative AIC, that is the AIC for just a stationary Poisson model, minus the AIC for that model. So higher will be a better score. And what do I get? If I only use relative humidity, I get a score of about 263. If I use BI instead, the score goes up a little bit, fits a little bit better. Whereas if I go to this model, where I'm using all of these variables, and again, these are all variables that are taken into, other than date, they're all variables that are taken into account in the BI, in the computation of the BI, I get a huge jump, 601.1. And jumps of two or more are considered statistically significant. So this is a hugely significant result. I thought, great, I'll present this to the wildfire people. They'll totally be convinced that the BI is terrible. You might imagine that the reaction was quite different. It was, while AIC may speak to statisticians, to the outside world, it's less than ideally convincing. So in order to demonstrate that the BI, that this kind of elementary point process model works so much better than BI, here's a graph that's supposed to illustrate that. You can imagine implementing a cutoff on each day. That is, if the average BI over all those stations is at least 150, let's say, then we're going to institute a cutoff. So you can imagine in these two models, look at the model where with just BI. So you can imagine implementing a cutoff where if the risk is higher than that cutoff, we'll issue a warning. Okay. And you can imagine doing the same thing with this model, and we could see how many more fires we predict with one model than the other on days with those warnings. Yeah. It's almost time. So this is just the punchline. You can see that this dashed curve is higher than this solid curve, indicating that the model I was proposing works better in every case than the BI. By comparison, if we pick specific cutoffs, so if we want to constrain ourselves to having on average 32 false alarms per year, using the BI, we'd about 22% of the wildfires that occur would occur on those days with alarms. Whereas using that model that's just exponential in all those variables, with the same false alarm rate, we'd get about 34% of the fires occurring on the days with alarms. So it's about a 50% increase in predictive efficacy. Similarly, if we looked at a BI of 200 as our cutoff, we'd have about 13 false alarms per year. 8.2% of the wildfires that occurred would have occurred on those days of alarms. Whereas using the other model, the exponential model, with the same false alarm rate, we'd get almost twice as many of the fires occurring on those days of alarms. So, okay, of course human interactions are a problem, but, and this is the last thing I'll say, that there is this kind of thing that David Friedman calls jujitsu, that if they're making the case that the BI is so great because it correlates with wildfires, then it seems okay for me to criticize that correlation. So although one might expect that even if the BI were perfect, it might not correlate with wildfire behavior, the fact that it's been justified based on its correlation with wildfire behavior, coupled with the fact that it doesn't correlate that well with wildfire behavior, may be seen as a problem. Let me just...